All right.
Hi, Reza.
Hey, how's it going?
Not bad. I'm Raihan Salam with the New America Foundation and the American Scene, and I'm here with Reza Aslan. Reza, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Reza Aslan. I am a columnist at the Daily Beast and the author most recently of How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror.
Reza, this is a great honor for me because you wrote one of the most important influential books, I'd say the last decade, No God But God, which was a really fascinating effort to kind of reinterpret Islam for a kind of wider, primarily Western audience, but that has also found, I think, a considerable audience in the Muslim world. And you've now written a strikingly ambitious book, and I was wondering if you might give us a brief synopsis of the book.
Sure. As I said, the book is called How to Win a Cosmic War, and it's essentially a book about religion and violence, but it's also a discussion about jihadism as a social movement. A cosmic war is a religious war. It's a war in which God is perceived to be directly engaged on one side and against the other. Unlike a holy war, which is essentially a war between two rival religions or adherents of rival religions, a cosmic war is a bit different. It's a war of the imagination. It's a war in which participants believe that they are acting out on Earth a battle that's actually taking place in the heavens between the cosmic forces of good and evil. The argument of the book essentially is that this is the war that the jihadists are fighting, a cosmic war, not a war that can be won in any kind of real or measurable terms, that their goals, their agendas, their ideologies are on this wholly other plane. Part of the sort of the problem, as I lay it out, is that by adopting the same religiously polarizing language and the same cosmic worldview as the jihadists, the Bush administration conceived of the war on terror also as a cosmic war. And the problem with that is that a cosmic war is a war that can't be won, because what's at stake is not any kind of political or economic or social issue, but really one's existential self. And in that regard, there's no such thing as a surrendering or negotiating or compromising. You're talking about a war between good and evil for the future of civilization. And that's a war that you can neither lose nor win. And so that is the argument for why the war on terror has been such a miserable failure in actually confronting the forces of radical Islam, and why it should be done away with altogether. And instead, we should begin to think of jihadism as a social movement, very much like the social movements of the last century, the anti-globalization movement, the radical environmental movement, even the civil rights movement, and sort of bring the cosmic war back down to earth by addressing the grievances that are behind the cosmic impulse.
You maintain a careful distinction between Islamism and jihadism. And when you're describing this social movement, do you feel that these are somehow interrelated and that these are both part of this broader religiously infused social movement?
That's a great question. And honestly, one of my biggest goals in writing this book was to really make a differentiation between these two movements that for so many years, especially under the Bush administration, have been conflated to be the same. Islamism is an ideology of religious nationalism. An Islamist wants to create an Islamic state based on a Muslim moral framework, whatever that means. Hamas, Hezbollah, these are Islamist organizations. Jihadism, in many ways, although it comes out of the same Islamist history, is the exact opposite of Islamism. Not only is it not a nationalist movement, it's an anti-nationalist movement. An Islamist wants to build an Islamic state. A jihadist wants to get rid of all states, all nations, all borders, all boundaries, all national identities, and to recreate the globe in this kind of utopian communal way, what they refer to as the caliphate. These are vastly different groups with vastly different agendas, and part of the problem in actually, you know, sufficiently confronting these forces is that we've conflated Islamist and jihadist ideas and created this undifferentiated enemy by creating these false connections between groups like Hamas and groups like Al-Qaeda.
So when you're talking about this model of social movement, I mean, my impression is that these Islamist movements, and you talk about the Muslim Brotherhood and many others you provide, really richly detailed portraits of their kind of intellectual worldviews, etc., and also their histories and how they've kind of manifested themselves over time. And I mean, is it that you see the kind of Islamist movements as akin to the civil rights movement, if not, you know, kind of obviously, you know, kind of identical in terms of moral posture, etc., but, you know, kind of similar in that they were reformist movements, whereas jihadism is something separate and distinct? Or do you see them, I mean, all as being social movements of a kind?
I think that you can treat both of them as social movements. The difference, of course, is that with Islamism, there is a real distinct sort of nationalist aspiration here that has to be dealt with. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that this notion of religious nationalism, whether it's Islamism or whether it's Christianism, Christian religious nationalism, which is quite strong here in the United States, or whether it's the Jewish sort of religious Zionist movements, the Jewish nationalist movements that are becoming so much more prevalent in places like Israel. My argument is that religious nationalism, sure, can be problematic, but it's something that can be dealt with. If you're a nationalist, that means you want something. And if you want something, you can be talked to. You can be negotiated with. The difference between the Islamists and the jihadists is that jihadists are essentially embroiled in what I call a cosmic war. And what they want can't be had in any kind of real or measurable terms, which is why, by the way, they so rarely talk about their goals, because their goals are so airy, getting rid of evil, for instance, recreating the globe, that to talk about them would be to admit how absurd and fanciful they actually are. But the reason I talk about jihadism as a social movement and as a transnational social movement, a social movement that goes beyond borders and boundaries, is precisely because we too often think about religion as this kind of separate issue, that religion is about personal confessional experience. But of course, certainly in the age of globalization, that's not the case. Religion is culture, it's ethnicity, it's more than anything else a matter of identity. And the more globalization begins to break down the sort of barriers between these old categories of religion and politics, the more we need to stop thinking about religious movements as sort of apolitical. Yes, the jihadists are fighting a cosmic war, but there is a real political aspiration in the things that they're talking about, the grievances that they bring up and that they use to create this collective identity. And so by using this framework of social movements, what I try to do is provide a means of actually confronting jihadism. Because the fact is that you can't change the minds of somebody whose sort of consciousness is resting on a completely different plane. They're not fighting for any kind of material values. But you can make the movement less significant by co-opting the grievances that they use in order to reach out to these sort of young, disaffected, marginalized Muslims around the world. And these grievances are quite legitimate grievances: the suffering of the Palestinians, American cultural hegemony, the lack of social or political rights in large parts of the Arab and Muslim world. But it is important to understand that while the grievances themselves are legitimate, as far as the jihadists are concerned, they're just symbols. They're symbols to rally around. And in the same way that the anti-globalization movement, which was quite violent and robust in the 90s, but which now is almost non-existent, it was defanged precisely by the fact that mainstream society absorbed the grievances of the anti-globalization movement, so that really now, I mean, you know, every college freshman knows about, you know, the problems of globalization, that in a sense it made the movement itself, the social movement itself, no longer important, no longer necessary. And that's the same thing that we can do with jihadism. And so essentially that's kind of the argument of the book, is how do we actually address and co-opt the grievances that fuel the jihadist movement?
One thing I find interesting, one interesting parallel is this, you know, the way that anti-globalization became, you know, alter mondialism, just the idea of, you know, instead of being anti, just offering alternatives, and the idea that this has some reflection in the evolution of Islamist politics, if not necessarily jihadist politics. I want to return to that issue, but first it occurs to me that there's a very obvious question I've certainly had on my mind, which is, How would you describe the transition between writing your first book, which was a kind of explication, to this book? I mean, how did you move from one to the other? Was it something in the course of discussing and traveling and, debating your first book that, continued to kind of raise these issues and made them seem pressing to you?
Yeah, thanks, Rayon. That's actually a really good question, because I didn't actually intend on writing this book. I had actually intended on writing a completely different book, but I was traveling around the world talking about No God But God, and of course the question was always about the war on terror and why was the war on terror, not actually adequately confronting radicalism? Why was it getting stronger? Even as Al-Qaeda as a militant organization was becoming weaker, the global jihadist movement behind Al-Qaeda was becoming stronger and more dominant, especially in places like Europe. And also, I've always been very interested in this concept of religion and violence, the role of violence in religion. I know that, for most people, they think that somehow these are anathema, that, that violence is kind of an adulteration of religion. And as a scholar of religions, I kind of wanted to explain to people that nothing could be further from the truth, that religion and violence go hand in hand and have always gone hand in hand. There's nothing strange about that. In fact, violence is as integral a part of religion as compassion or faith or any other aspect of the religious endeavor, because both religion and violence are essentially, effective group-forming mechanisms. And so they go hand in hand very, very easily. And so the book, of course, talks a lot about the religion and violence in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, both past and present. That sort of all kind of came together, this idea of cosmic warfare, religion and violence, jihadism, and the failure of the war on terror, through, a year of traveling around the globe, talking to various groups and audiences, and this book just kind of naturally arose from that.
One thing that I found interesting in the book, you talk at some length, very persuasively, I think, about these, some call them diaspora communities of young Muslims. And, you discuss the work of Mark Sageman, the psychologist who's done a great deal of work in kind of analyzing the terrorist frame of mind, and also the kind of social networks that make up the kind of, jihadist networks that, we [S2] Right. [S1] Confront. And I wonder, you also, you're an immigrant who experienced kind of displacement and sort of this whole process of, kind of acclimating to a new culture. And you also talk about your own experiences. I wonder if you can sort of talk about that a bit and about how your own personal experiences have kind of informed the lens that you use to kind of see these communities.
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things I sort of talk about in the book is that the epicenter of the global jihadist movement is not in the Middle East. It's not in the Arab world. It's not in the Muslim world at all. It's in Europe. And there's a very simple reason for that, and that has to do with the immigration experience. I came to the United States from Iran in 1979, and I spent a lot of time in researching this book in Europe, in the UK, in France, in Germany, in Italy, in the Netherlands, all these places in which, these sort of very large Muslim immigrant communities are mostly ethnically isolated, segregated from the rest of society, not really given an opportunity to really assimilate into society, except insofar as that assimilation means getting rid of their own identities, their cultural and religious and even ethnic identities, and absorbing the identity of Europe. And the issue for me, and there's a lot of reasons, by the way, why Muslims in the United States, some 7 million Muslims, are solidly middle class. 60% of Muslims in this country own their own homes. The median income for a Muslim household in the United States is actually greater than for a non-Muslim household. And certainly Muslims here in the U.S. are thoroughly integrated in almost every level of society. And the exact opposite is true for Muslims in Europe. And yes, economic issues has something to do with it, but it's more than that. It's a sense that the United States has a very easily accessible national identity that can be absorbed by anyone, regardless of their culture, their ethnicity, or their religion. Whereas in Europe, and particularly post-EU, there is a real sort of vacuum of identity where the British, the French, the Italians, the Germans, the Dutch are really having a difficult time trying to figure out their own national identity. What does it mean to be at once Dutch and European, or German and European, in a continent that is fast becoming borderless. And if you can imagine, if sort of indigenous Germans or indigenous Italians themselves can't figure out the question of what it means to be German or Italian, how much more difficult is that for an immigrant or children of immigrants? And so an identity vacuum is created among these marginalized communities, particularly the young. And they are desperate for a sense of belonging, something that gives them this sort of collective identity that's not based on any kind of national or ethnic conceptions. And jihadism provides that identity. Bin Laden answers the question of why don't I feel either Pakistani or British. Bin Laden's answer to that is because you're neither Pakistani nor British. You're just a Muslim. You're part of a global community of Muslims. And creating this identity also develops this master narrative of suffering and oppression at the hands of a quote-unquote crusading West. And so the sort of solution for dealing with jihadism in Europe is precisely to sever that connection, to sever that collective identity, and to create a much more robust, much more easily accessible national identity that Muslims, regardless of what country they live in Europe, can identify with, that they can absorb into their own sense of self, and that they can feel at once Muslim and British, Muslim and German, the way the very successful 7 million Muslims in the United States feel.
Here's something I find interesting. Early on in the book, you talk about the nation state and how Max Weber's definition of the nation state is in some sense inadequate, the idea that the nation state has a monopoly on the use of force, whereas in fact the nation state is actually so pervasive in its influence, the way that it regulates sexual mores, the way that it governs our economic life. It's so pervasive that it almost takes on a kind of repressive cast. And just thinking back to the way that globalization, the anti-globalization movement has evolved into this kind of, alternative globalization movement, I wonder, this takes us a little bit away from the book, and we will get back to it, but can you imagine an alternative jihadism, as odd as that sounds to our ears, but one that, emphasizes this collective transnational Muslim identity, but that rather than being oriented towards, rigidifying and enforcing repression against women, is oriented toward, for example, economic justice or environmentalism or, yes. I mean, this sounds like very airy-fairy, but I mean, I do wonder, as someone who has thought very deeply about the Muslim tradition, in a kind of different, alternative light, can you imagine that? Because when you're talking about the kind of cosmopolitanism of the jihadists, it's interesting because many of the things that you say parallel what we think of as, traditional cosmopolitan Western
That's
liberalism
right.
in its disregard of skin color, et cetera. And these are the things that, my mother, would always emphasize to me about the Muslim tradition, its inclusiveness. So, I mean, I wonder what you think about that as a possibility.
Yeah, that's a really great way of putting it. My professor, when I was doing my doctorate at UCSB, Mark Juergensmeyer, refers to jihadism as anti-globalization globalists, or as John Gray at the London School of Economics puts it, they pretend to be, they are a symptom of the issue that they pretend to be the cure for. I said that pretty poorly, but you're absolutely right. And actually, to be perfectly frank, there are a number of transnational Muslim social movements that function very much like jihadism, but are engaged in peaceful work or positive work. The most famous of this, of course, is the Gulen movement that's based in Turkey, which has hundreds of millions of adherents in every part of the world, but is based on sort of traditional Islamic values of peace and justice, etc. Another movement that's similar to jihadism but not violent is Hizb ut-Tahrir, which is also a movement that seeks to erase all borders and boundaries and get rid of all ethnicities and national identities and to reconstitute the globe in this caliphate, which, seems like a scary word, but basically it's just about kind of a new sense of globalism. So jihadism isn't alone as a transnational social movement. But there is something that you brought up really interesting in this issue of Weber, because you're right. You know, that old definition of the nation state having a monopoly on force is inadequate. Really, what the nation state has a monopoly on is identity, and this has been part of the process of the 20th century. The whole point of secular nationalism was that we were supposed to replace our ethnic and our religious identities with the nation state, that the nation state was supposed to become our primary marker of identity, and as such, it was deliberately meant to replace religion as that sort of core source of collective identity. Well, again, you know, this was always a problematic notion to begin with, because for most people, you know, their identities cannot be reduced just to their national, you know, identity. There's much more primal forms of identity, like ethnicity, like culture, like religion, that are always going to kind of exert themselves. But now, thanks to globalization and the weakening of the nation state, the more these sort of borders become porous, the more identity is no longer restricted by geography. And we're seeing this, by the way, not just in the developing world, but even in a place like the United States, which I sometimes joke will be the last nation state remaining by the end of this century. The fact of the matter is that the more globalization begins to erase borders and boundaries, the more people are going to connect their identities in different ways, not according to, you know, landscape or geography, but according to what is often referred to as post-materialist values, mores or even you know, likes, even hobbies become in many ways the way in which identities are now starting to form. And thanks to the internet, we're no longer restrained by any kind of borders or boundaries. You know, my core identity can be based around heavy metal music, and I could sort of connect to other people like me who may not speak the same language, who may not have the same culture or ethnicity, but that we can sort of connect with each other, create this collective identity based on our interests and our values and the things that we hold dear.
Yeah, I think that this is one thing that I often think about intellectual life. I mean, the way that our imaginative frames are so kind of limited, the way that, you know, the nation state is very familiar, yet it is easy to imagine a totally alternative set of arrangements that could have emerged historically that happened not to. This, though, brings to mind just, I want to press you a little bit on this. So when you're talking about the strategy for these diaspora minorities that are, you know, excluded from society and that are resentful, you offer, you know, genuine assimilation into a kind of broader national identity, a kind of American-style solution as where Europe ought to go next. At the same time, you seem to have a sympathy, and understandably so, for this idea of transnational Muslim movements. Because, you know, the nation state, I mean, you talk about how it's eroding relative to these primary loyalties. And as an intellectual, you know, do you feel as though maybe a more productive orientation would be to invest yourself in thinking through, you know, like the Ghulam movement, you know, how can you construct these alternatives to jihadism, but that actually sort of draw on the same kind of idealism, and that also draw on the same kind of primary loyalties as a strategy for, you know, the next 100 years, say?
This is an excellent point. And, you know, there's a real argument, of course, among scholars about, you know, the future of the nation state. I think that, you know, the majority of sociologists would say that this notion that, you know, we're getting to a place where the world is fast becoming a single space without borders is an exaggeration, and that the nation state will continue to survive past this century. Honestly, I don't know where I stand on that argument. I am myself a transnationalist. I believe in globalization. I think that certainly there are problems with it, but it's a good thing, and that it's an irreversible thing. But I do also recognize that national identity it still exerts a real primacy in people, and that as far as, you know, when it comes to the issue of Europe and the problems that Europe is having with its you know, younger Muslim population, the real issue when you talk to these Muslims is that they want to be part of Europe. I've had this conversation maybe 1,000 times with Muslims across the continent, where they say the same thing over and over again. Tell me what it is that you want from me. Tell me how to be British, and I'll do it. I follow the laws. I, you know, follow the Constitution. I speak your language. I look like you. I dress like you. Why is it that I still feel like you don't see me as part of society? And so, you know, one of the sort of cures that I offer is it, like you said, this kind of American style idea of civic identity, the creation of an identity based not on ethnicity or any kind of cultural homogeneity, but on a, you know, set of principles, on a narrative that anyone from any culture or any society can absorb into themselves. This, of course, is what makes America so successful. We are, as demographers will say, soon to become the first society in the world to be majority-minority. And that, I think, is an incredible statement about how strong and yet malleable the American national identity is. Whereas if you go to, say, France, which also has a strong national identity, it's a very rigid one. It's one that says, for you to become like us, you must strip yourself of your cultural or ethnic or religious affiliations and take on what we define as French identity. Well, that becomes incredibly difficult for, say, a Muslim who may be born in France, but who still maintains, you know, allegiance to his faith and his culture and his traditions. And so, you know, I think that it's overly simplistic to say that the cure for jihadism is a stronger national identity. But that's certainly a part of it. At the same time, you're right. We do need to foster these other transnationalist movements that compete with jihadism, that use the same, you know, tools of globalization, but compete with jihadism and offer, I think, an alternative message, an alternative identity for young Muslims based not on issues of violence or revolution, but on compassion and social justice.
I've been thinking about this a lot for a long time, just because, you know, when you see a lot of the successful democratic Islamist parties, if you look at the AK party, et cetera, which, you know, is problematic in many respects, but I think that, you know, it's easy to see it as a broadly successful model of political inclusion, akin in some respects to Christian democracy, et cetera,
yes.
Versus these kind of broader ideas. And one reason it occurs to me, while reading your book, I noticed something that was very similar to something that Royal Gerecht had written. Royal Gerecht is best known as a kind of neoconservative foreign policy analyst, but he wrote once, I thought very astutely, that when you're thinking about Europe's Muslim population, there's this perception that it's, you know, totally radicalized. But, you know, he said that, no, actually, most European Muslims have assimilated and are actually secular, much like their European neighbors and friends. And, you know, while intermarriage rates are not high, I mean, they vary across, I mean, sort of, you know, but there's some, et cetera, but that the people who maintain a religious identity, they have been marginalized. And so that's where you see the extremist turn. His point was that there is no religious center. You know, in the United States, you have, you know, in theory, I mean, you do have these kind of fringe religious movements that are extreme, but you also have this broad religious center where, you know, people engage in civic participation, et cetera, and they, you know, have these robust primary loyalties. And I wonder what you make of this. I mean, this idea of this broader set of European national identities, these civic identities, that's one thing, and that's one area where the kind of these nation states can move, or these kind of, you know, cultures can move to meet these kind of minority populations halfway. At the same time, you know, where does that religious center come from?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because to some extent, I mean, you know, you see, you know, in some places you have lots of imams who are imported from abroad. You know, you don't really have this kind of indigenous movement for religious moderation, partly because, you know, how do you have a movement for moderation? You know what I mean? But I wonder what do you think of that?
Yeah, this is, I mean, I make a similar point in the book that, you know, the vast, vast majority of Muslims in Europe are thoroughly integrated and assimilated into society. They're deeply European. And in fact, to be honest, jihadism in Europe is itself deeply European. You know, the language that it uses, the rights that it demands, you know, it's much more influenced by the Magna Carta than it is by the Quran, to be perfectly honest with you. You know, this is a larger point about the role of religion in society. I mean, obviously, whatever you want to say about the United States, Obama's right, we're not a Christian nation. But we are a nation that believes that religion is a good thing, that it's a positive force, that it does have a role to play in the public realm. And in fact, we encourage religion to play that role. We don't see a real disconnect between one's religious identity and one's national identity. But as you well know, that is not the case in large parts of Europe. And indeed, when you talk to Muslims in Europe, they say that it's not just the fact that I'm Muslim that makes me feel that I don't belong in Europe. It's that I have religious faith, and that faith in a religion like Islam, which, you know, has a lot of outward expressions, the way you dress, the way you eat, it's not sort of a religion that you can kind of hide from public. In and of itself, that makes me somehow foreign or exotic to Europeans. I really don't know, you know, what the prescription to this is. You know, I'd like to say as an American that, well, you know, Europe ought to be more religious. They ought to, you know, allow religion to have a greater say in society. And then they will find that it actually can be beneficial, that it's not necessarily just a bad thing to have you know, a public role for faith and discussions about faith, that it can be part of the marketplace of ideas. But I would imagine, and actually I don't need to imagine this, I know for a fact that a lot of Europeans would vigorously disagree with that. At the same time, I do think that the primary issue here is making a disconnect to severing the notion that ethnicity and nationality are one and the same thing. And that's the real problem in large parts of Europe. Certainly in Italy, in Germany, in France, in the Netherlands, you hear this all the time, that, you know, being ethnically German and being nationally German is one and the same. And so therefore, it doesn't matter how many generations, you know, your family has lived in Germany. If you're of Turkish background, you're still not really German. What is the answer to that? You know, again, from an outsider's perspective, I say the answer to that is to create a much stronger, you know, sense of civic identity. And you see this happening in the UK. The UK has been adopting sort of the American model, trying to put together a very easily accessible sense of British national identity that anyone of any religion or any culture or ethnicity can absorb. And, you know, we'll have to see what the success of that is going to be. But this is something that the rest of Europe is woefully lacking.
Much of your book is talking about the war on terrorism framework. And it's interesting because this is an interesting moment. You write a lot about 7/7, the terrorist attack in London that really shocked the country but had a very interesting political upshot. Namely, Gordon Brown, then, you know, having newly replaced Tony Blair, took a rhetorical stance that was sharply different from that taken by Tony Blair and also by George W. Bush earlier on. Namely, he really emphasized the extent to which the 7/7 plotters were criminals. He talked about it as a criminal conspiracy. He emphasized not that this was some kind of civilizational struggle, but that this was an area where the security services and the police and the citizenry had to be kind of watchful and wary, but that this was, you know, fundamentally a problem that was one that could be sort of narrowly targeted through sort of means of sort of the judiciary and the police, et cetera. Do you feel as though there's been a big shift? And similarly, you know, during the Democratic primaries, there's a lot of talk about, you know, jettisoning the war on terrorism framework. I wonder if you think that that goal has been achieved to some extent.
I think it's happening. You know, one of the sort of exciting things for me as this book is about to come out is to see the discussion taking place in the Obama administration, albeit in a quiet way, because I don't think they want to make too big a deal out of this, because the criticism from the right would just be, it wouldn't be overwhelming, but it would be disruptive to just abandon the whole war on terror metaphor and that rhetoric, the sort of cosmic war rhetoric, us versus them, clash of civilizations rhetoric that was so much a part the Bush administration's attempt to confront jihadism, and frankly, to take a much more European model, much more British model. When you look at the problem that the UK is having with its Muslim population, their success is actually quite astounding. You know, they don't have anywhere near the problem with jihadist movements and cells that the United States has. And yet they have managed to really bring, you know, the vast majority of British Muslims on board with this sort of program to confront these radical forces within their society, precisely by treating jihadists, these terrorist movements, as a criminal conspiracy, as you say, and not as some sort of, well, to use John McCain's word, transcendent evil that seeks to destroy everything that we stand for and believe in. This is absurd. I mean, these kinds of rhetorical, you know, excesses are precisely what is keeping us from actually succeeding in this so-called ideological conflict with radical Islam. I mean, as I say,
I want to clarify one quick thing. I mean, do you think that actually? So, are you saying that the United States faces more of a threat from indigenous? Kind of Islamist terror. Okay,
No. I said the UK faces far more of a threat,
and yet,
they've done a marvelous job in managing that threat, precisely because they've abandoned this kind of, you know, clash of civilizations rhetoric and replaced it with, you know, this conception that they're confronting a criminal conspiracy and it requires proper police work. That, I think, is something that you're going to start seeing a lot more here in the U.S. Already, Secretary of State Clinton, of course, has indicated that the administration will no longer use the war on terror rhetoric. As far as I know, and I've been monitoring this very carefully, in the 3 months that Obama has been president, he's yet to use the term war on terror, which in and of itself is remarkable. And I do recognize that this is kind of a quiet revolution. They're not making a big deal out of it. I think it's a good first step. If this is a war of ideology, then obviously words become our greatest weapons. And I think that that Obama understands this in a way that gives me a lot of confidence and a lot of optimism for the way that his administration is going to ultimately confront jihadism. Now, granted, they haven't done anything yet. They're sort of, you know, a little bit distracted by a global economic collapse, but nevertheless, I think that they are laying the proper groundwork for dealing with jihadism as a social movement and not, as the previous administration did, as a transcendent evil that seeks to destroy civilization.
Well, on the other hand, just to push back gently,
you don't have to be gentle. You don't have to be gentle.
No, well, you know, I think that I'm just gentle by nature, I guess. But the idea of a transcendent evil, I mean, it does seem to have tight parallels with, and you say this as well, with the self-perception of the jihadist movement. And when you look at the project of the caliphate, I mean, I tend to agree with you that that actually, well, I mean, maybe I don't agree with you, but sort of my own view is that these guys are actually pretty marginal and that the best way to deal with them is by, you know, killing them. And, you know, it's basically a criminal conspiracy and that, you know, they want to be seen as much more powerful and influential than they are.
That's right.
But I think that, you know, it is true that, you know, you said earlier on that, you know, when jihadists are articulating their end state goals, it actually sounds so preposterous that it's actually hard to take them seriously.
Yeah, it really is.
But because it's, you know, kind of so radically at variance with the way the world works, et cetera. And I'm sort of, you know, I sort of feel that, you know, the kind of rhetoric of transcendent evil, I guess I always saw it as a political calibration problem. For example, you could argue that 9/11 demonstrated that the United States should care a lot more about failed states, because failed states, among other things, become a hub of lots of activity that, you know, can be hurtful to us. Not only terrorist activity, but, you know, kind of a panoply of things, human trafficking, drug trafficking, et cetera. I mean, you know, the argument can be made at least. And that the problem of failed states is actually, you know, kind of fairly, you know, you have a lot of it in sub-Saharan Africa, you have it, you know, in lots of regions of the world. Yet to mobilize the public in order to meet this threat, in order to actually gin up the resources that you need to tackle the threat of failed states, which again is kind of a hard thing for mass publics to get their head around, arguably, you need a kind of rhetoric that is going to really...
Oh, no question.
And so, like, I kind of, to some extent, I think of this, this sounds very cynical of me, but to some extent, I think that, you know, the leadership of the U.S. and Britain and a variety of other societies after 9/11 faced a kind of impossible problem. Because, you know, there was the shock and outrage, and then you want to channel that shock and outrage into effective action. But actually doing it by actually lowering the temperature, you know, would have actually been kind of hard. Does that make sense to you?
This makes perfect sense to me. And this is, you know, as a religion scholar, you know, who's fascinated by the role of religion in society, I know better than anyone that the language of religion is the language that holds the most currency for the masses. And that, particularly in the United States, I mean, our social, political, even economic ideals and agendas are deeply infused by religious language. And certainly, you know, the war on terror is not the first time that the U.S. administration has used starkly religious language and even religiously polarizing language in order to confront, you know, its enemies. I mean, FDR would refer to Hitler in these dramatically demonic, satanic terms and really spoke of Nazism as very much a transcendent evil. So it's perfectly natural, and I recognize how natural the impulse is, except that we are engaged in a conflict with an entity that is fighting not a real war, but a cosmic war. A entity that feels as though they are embroiled in a cosmic battle between good and evil. And when we adopt that same language, when we use the same good-evil language, when we talk in the same cosmic terms, when we use the same Manichaean, religiously polarizing language, what we do is we validate their viewpoint. We essentially tell them that they're right. This is a cosmic conflict. And just because we think we're on the side of good and you're on the side of evil is irrelevant. And by doing so, we've empowered this very small, very marginal group of individuals and turned them into the global force that they actually are. One thing that you are absolutely correct on, and I say this very clearly in the book, is that, you know, these jihadist leaders, the cosmic warriors, you know, surrounding bin Laden, they cannot be negotiated with. There's nothing to talk about. They want nothing that can be had in any real or measurable terms. They can only be confronted by violence. They can only be hunted down and captured and killed. But they're just the tip of the iceberg of the problem. The problem is this larger movement, this social movement that these individuals represent. And for them, violence, you know, cannot be an answer. There's no way that you could sort of militarily confront a social movement. In fact, that's how you actually radicalize a social movement, by oppressing it and by using violence. And this, again, brings me back to something Obama said in Turkey, which, I was there and heard him say these words, and it really rang so true, which is that, yes, there are those that cannot be talked to, they must be confronted militarily, but that violence cannot defeat an ideology. And, you know, this is sort of the beginning of this notion. You know, the Bush administration made similar comments, but they never actually acted upon those statements. The way that they acted was often actually in complete contradiction to their notion of this sort of war of ideas and you know, using words and ideas in order to confront radical Islam. We never really tried anything like that. Making a couple of commercials isn't really the answer. So again, I feel very confident thus far in the Obama administration's recognition of what the problem truly is and how to actually address it.
I have a somewhat unrelated question. In your book, you write about the Palestinian struggle. Yeah. And about the role that it plays in the Islamic self-perception in the politics of these twin social movements, both Islamist nationalist That's social right. movements as well as the transnational jihadist social movement. And, you know, one thing that I want you to talk about that, but I also just want, as a provocation, to say that I've always been very vexed by the outsized role played by the Palestinian experience versus, for example, Gujarat, where you had pogroms against the Muslim population there, or simply the kind of dire poverty that many Muslims live in Bangladesh, where my parents are from, throughout sub-Saharan Africa, etc. It just seems interesting to me that the struggles of the Palestinian population, which are absolutely real, just play such an outsized role relative to all these other things. And sometimes it reminds me of the kind of Arabic ethnocentrism of the Islamic world, something that, you know, a number of folks have commented on. And I just sort of wonder what you think about that.
No, I mean, look, you're absolutely right. And let's not forget, you know, the oppression of the Chechens, the genocide of the Bosnians, the horrible situation of the Uyghur Muslims under Chinese rule. Yes, you're right. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that for better or worse, Palestine has become the sort of sole pan-Islamism. You know, it's the only thing that the Muslim world has in common anymore, and certainly the only thing that the Arab world has in common anymore, is this sort of Palestinian intifada propaganda. It's become, you know, the most obvious means of creating an identity. And that's precisely why, by the way, that the jihadists rely on it so much. Here's the funny thing, is that, you know, bin Laden couldn't care less about the Palestinians, and certainly he doesn't care about the Palestinian struggle for statehood. Bin Laden is an anti-nationalist. The last thing that he wants to see is a Palestinian state. He doesn't care about that. Which, by the way, is why you don't see any jihadists, any foreign jihadists, fighting alongside, you know, Hamas or Islamic Jihad. They wouldn't be welcomed there. You know, they have vastly different viewpoints of the problem and how to deal with it. But what is brilliant about the jihadist movement is that it has used the problem of Palestine, the grievance of Palestine, as the sort of easiest way to kind of connect these local and global grievances and create this collective identity amongst, you know, Muslims who may have nothing else in common with each other, who don't share the same ethnicity, the same culture, the same language, and even don't even share the same religion. Jihadism, you know, religiously speaking, is quite heterogeneous, but who can come together and create a sense of belonging and identity based around a set of local and global grievances, the most obvious of which is the suffering of the Palestinians. Now, we could say that it's not fair, that it's not representative, that it's sort of a simplification of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. All of that is irrelevant. The fact of the matter is that this is reality, and that unless it's addressed, that grievance will always be used to fuel these kinds of both Islamist and jihadist movements. This is problem number one. It's the beginning and end of every discussion that has to do with any kind of religio-political movement in the Muslim world. And until it is properly dealt with, it's sort of impossible to kind of not just confront these movements, but to even hope for any kind of real, lasting social, political, religious, or even economic reform in the Arab and Muslim world, because Palestine will always be the crutch that's used to deflect any kind of responsibility from these governments themselves, from Egypt, from Jordan, from Algeria, from Morocco, or from Iran. It's used to deflect any responsibility for their own, you know, lack of development.
One related argument that I always found interesting, Michael Scott Duran some years ago wrote a piece for Foreign Affairs in which he argued that protests about Palestine are oftentimes the only means through which religious minorities, for example, the Shia Muslims of Saudi Arabia and other, you know, kind of similarly placed groups, can actually express their grievances, though they're actually not allowed to articulate their own grievances through this kind of protest around, you know, the plight of the Palestinians.
Right.
You know, kind of they're able to actually engage in some kind of civic activism. I am very interested in what you have to say. How has your, in the course of writing this book, I also remember that you were opposed to Barack Obama becoming the Democratic nominee. If I recall correctly, you were a Hillary Clinton fan.
Yeah, I wasn't opposed to Barack Obama. It's just, you know, I worked for Hillary because she asked first.
I see. Oh, well, I just want to know, like, sort of how, you know, kind of your kind of view of their kind of respective foreign policies. I mean, did you sort of detect substantial differences, or do you think that they were both kind of running along the same stream in terms of their view of the Muslim world?
Well, let me put it this way. I was sort of close enough to the Clinton campaign and close enough, you know, to friends who were in the Obama campaign to know that their foreign policy was almost identical, and that the reason that Clinton came off as more hawkish is, and let's just be frank, is that she needed to be. She, as a woman, she needed to come off as much more hawkish and much stronger than she actually was. And I actually think that, you know, having her as Secretary of State is a brilliant maneuver, because it does allow them to sort of play this, I don't know, I guess good cop, bad cop is a bit of a cliche, but you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
I will say this, you're absolutely right about this issue of Palestine, and the best example of this, of course, was the war between Israel and Gaza, you know, over the fall, December, where you saw protests in Cairo, which were outwardly protests against Israel, but which were quite clearly and obviously protests against the Mubarak regime. But of course, if you go out onto the streets of Cairo and you protest Mubarak, you're never heard from again. But if you go out there and you protest the U.S., you protest Israel, then you have, you know, the freedom to actually make your voice heard. And you can use that grievance to make similar grievances about, you know, your own domestic situation. This is what I meant by sort of the genius of jihadism being able to connect local grievances, you know, the lack of social mobility in Egypt, to global grievances, the suffering of the Palestinians, to create one single master narrative of suffering and oppression. And the importance of you know, severing that link in order to adequately confront jihadism. So you're absolutely right about this. But this goes back again to what we were saying. You know, once again, it goes back to Palestine. Whether it's fair or not, whether it's realistic or not, this is the fundamental issue that is creating this sense of identity, not just amongst, you know, jihadist groups, but also amongst Islamist groups, and it has to be dealt with. I am positive and optimistic about the Obama-Clinton foreign policy team, but I am not optimistic about the two-state solution, especially under Netanyahu and Lieberman. I don't see this happening, and frankly, there is a clock ticking. And if the status quo continues the way it is now, you can pretty much kiss the two-state solution goodbye.
One question I want to ask, and we've touched upon this a bit earlier on, but is whether or not Islamism can be an antidote for jihadism. Given the distinction between the two, and we talked about this idea of civic identity in the European context, but I wonder if you're looking at the emergence of kind of semi-democratic states in the Muslim world, and certainly the example of Turkey is an interesting one. Do you see that as something that, you know, we in the West should engage more seriously? Do you think that we should look to the idea of a kind of more reformist democratic Islamism as a kind of strong positive?
No question. In fact, I say these exact words, that Islamism can be the sort of antidote to jihadism. Because the fact of the matter is that religious nationalism is a perfectly valid and understandable impulse, whether it's Jewish nationalism or Christian nationalism or Muslim nationalism in the case of Islamism. If you live in a democratic society, then it's only natural for people to want their mores and their values and their customs and the things that they hold dear to be a part of the marketplace of ideas, to have a role in society. We allow, you know, our Christianists here in the United States to have a political voice, and then we give the public an opportunity to actually vote on those ideals and whether they agree with them or not. The real fear is that if you suppress religious nationalism, then it can become transnationalist. In other words, if you suppress Islamism, it can transform into jihadism. And while Islamism is something that can be dealt with, it can be negotiated with, and frankly, not just the example of Turkey, but the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, the Islamic Action Front in Jordan, and literally dozens of other Islamist groups from Morocco to Algeria to Tunisia to even Bangladesh and in Indonesia, have proven over and over again that when given an opportunity to become a part of the political process within certain parameters and rules, given an opportunity to actually make their voices heard on the political stage, without exception, these groups tend to moderate their behavior, moderate their ideology. The same can be true for Hamas, and in fact, I believe that it's proving to be true. The same is true for Hezbollah. There's a very, very simple reason why Hezbollah did not join the war between Israel and Gaza in December. That's because there are elections being held very soon in Lebanon. And Hezbollah, now that it is part of the political process in Lebanon, will not do anything to jeopardize its political future. There's no reason to think that if you give these religious nationalists an opportunity to make their voices heard, that they won't follow the lead of the AK party or the Muslim Brotherhood and moderate their tendencies. But in any case, whether you believe that to be the case or not, there really is no choice anymore. There's no say in the matter. There is no such thing as political reform in the Muslim world without engaging the Islamists. So we really have no choice.
One thing I found interesting, I mentioned Royal Direct before, and I think that there are many interesting parallels between your respective views. I imagine, you know, you don't think of yourself as a neoconservative. having read the book, I think we can safely say that. But I think that within the neoconservative tradition, there are lots of different conflicts over attitudes toward Islamic democracy, and particularly with regards to these religious nationalist movements that you describe. You have some who are kind of sharply critical. You mentioned in the book when you're talking about the Palestinian crisis about how democratization was very much in tension with some of these kind of broader goals of U.S. foreign policy. At the same time, you know, Gerecht in particular has strongly made the argument that, yes, you know, by pressing for democracy, you are oftentimes empowering highly conservative and highly anti-American tendencies within these societies, but that nevertheless is actually something that ought to be done precisely because it actually undermines jihadism for all the reasons that you describe. And I wonder if there's some room for kind of productive engagement, a constructive engagement, I should say, around these issues.
I think
so. But is there anything that you kind of want to convey about the book before we wrap up? Because, you know, it's an incredibly rich, I want to hold it up, it's an incredibly rich text that covers just a really wide variety of issues. You know, it obviously does touch on this kind of core foreign policy question, but beyond that, I think that it's a really fantastic guide to understanding a lot of these intellectual currents, both in the Western world and certainly in the Islamic world. But yeah, is there anything else that you really want to...
Well, you know, the only other thing that I would say is that, you know, we're in a moment right now in which we're really beginning to not just sort of reconsider how we're going to confront radical Islam and these sort of militant forces and jihadism, but we're in a moment in which we're really starting to redefine who we are as a nation. And I, as a supporter of democracy in the Muslim world and particularly in the Arab world, as a guy who believes that, you know, George Bush got this one thing right, that democracy and political participation is the solution to, you know, these radical tendencies in the Muslim world, I really hope and pray that the Obama administration doesn't just sort of in a knee-jerk way abandon the quote-unquote Bush doctrine, by which I mean this notion of actively promoting democracy in the Muslim world. I don't think they will, but you know, this is something that we've already opened the door to, and you know, as you just mentioned, you know, there's no way around this anymore. Yes, it's true, as I kind of end the book with, that just an election does not a democracy make. But you know what? Two elections in a row, three consecutive elections, that's a pretty good start. And what we need to do is we need to support those Islamist groups who are willing to pick up the ballot box and put down their weapons. We need to give them an opportunity, even if their interests and their values are not in alignment with ours. You know, this is a messy process. It's going to be a bumpy ride, no question about it. But not only is it the right way to confront these sort of extremist forces, it's at this point the only way. There is no other option except to just kind of, you know, buckle up and ride the Islamist wave and assume and hope and help it to moderate and become a you know, form of responsible governance as it has in Egypt, in Indonesia, in Turkey, and in Morocco, in Jordan, and in many other places of the Muslim world.
Well, I guess that wraps up our discussion, but just two things I want to add. One is that I just want to reiterate that you should absolutely buy this book because
thanks,
it really is a compelling read, and it's something that I think, you know, regardless of whether or not this is kind of your thing, you know what I mean? It's just a set of issues that you will be dealing with in the years to
yeah.
come. And I think that, you know,
it's not going away.
But the other thing I want to mention is to you in particular, Reza, I really think that your next book should be about this idea of an alternative jihadism, the idea of alternative Muslim transnational social movements, and it would be a place where you can bring to bear a lot of your own thoughts and your own kind of interpretation of Islam, because and it's the kind of book that I could imagine having lots of influence in these kind of fast modernizing slices of the Islamic world. I see you as a kind of you know, Muhammad Ali figure who could electrify the Islamic world, and I think that you'd be crazy not to give it a shot by writing sort of this kind of definitive text.
Well, I do float like a butterfly, and I do sting like a bee, so there you go. I'm writing this down, actually, Rayhan. I'm serious. This is a great idea. I'm writing this down, and I'm going to talk to my editors right now about it.
Yeah, you seriously should, and I fully expect to get, like, a large slice of your royalty.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
All right, thanks a lot, Reza. It was great talking to you.
Thanks, Rayhan. It was great to talk to you, too. Yeah.